Hi, with a flick of a switch, we turn night to day and day to night. We can change seasons, actions, and states of mind. Light is everywhere, used endlessly and very much a part of our modern world. But what is it? How do we use it? And how is it changing our environment and our behaviours? A starfield sky used to be our evening's entertainment. Now it's Netflix, iPads, or even a podcast. When was the last time you looked at the night sky? I'm Marnie Ogg, and this is Dark Sky Conversations, the podcast that brings people and science together to shed light. As an invited speaker at the 2019 LED Symposium, optometrist Stephen Mason said he wanted to show how LED lighting could reduce myopia and macular degeneration and motivate LED manufacturers to resolve this issue. His extensive research in LED lighting led Stephen to file two patents, one in 2017. His groundbreaking design modifies light to protect against long-term exposure to high-energy visible light. The Managing Director of Sustainable Eye Health, a Fellow of the American Academy of Optometry, the past President of the Australian Optometrical, I knew I'd get that wrong, Association, and Lecturer of the Optometrists Association of Australia, Stephen's background spans the full spectrum. Thanks for joining me today, Stephen.
It's a pleasure, Marnie.
Thank you. And before we go too far down the track, I have to say I was talking to a colleague this morning in the lighting world, and she was a speaker at our conference at Riding the Light Wave of Technology, which I held last year at Siding Spring. And unfortunately, you were unable to attend, but you did do a fantastic presentation, which we'll have online afterwards as well, about the eye. And she said that was the most riveting piece that she'd ever heard. She was really stunned by it. So thank you.
Thank you for the positive feedback.
And it was for that reason that I thought it was really important to invite you along and discuss the lighting issues. So let's go right back to the beginning. As an optometrist, what does light mean to you?
Central to what I do is the correction of vision. And I think if you ask most optometrists, their primary concern is ensuring that people have comfortable, clear, corrected vision when it's required. And of course, mixed in with that is prescribing often visual aids that protect our eyes as well against, for example, you know, harsh sunlight and so on. So in our training, much of our thinking goes into prescribing spectacles and contact lenses and so on that are designed to correct for comfortable vision and to prescribe something that is designed for the tasks that we are called upon to do with our eyes. Over the last probably decade or so, in my case, I've come to appreciate more and more how light, which, you know, on the one hand, as an Australian optometrist, we see the harmful effects of light on the surface of the eye, particularly, you know, pterygiums and pinguiculae. These are disorders of the front surface. To some degree, cataract is caused by long exposure to UV light. So we see the negative effects, and we're certainly trained to deal with all of that. But the last decade or so, my mind has turned to the potential beneficial effects of light.
Fantastic.
And that's where I guess my thinking has turned in the last few years. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And was there a particular moment that made you pivot and see the benefits of light?
Well, there was actually. For the last almost 8, 9 years of practice, my practice in optometry was in a beachside suburb of Sydney, Mona Vale. And we lived in Avalon, which is a suburb or two north.
Where I was born.
Yeah. And my sons, I have three. My eldest son, Tom, is a particularly keen surfer. And we always wondered why he would surf late in the day, very late in the day, when the sun's going down, you know, when the sharks are swimming around.
Yes, exactly.
And Tracy, my wife, commented to me one day, you know, have you ever thought about why Tom surfs in the dark? And I said, not really. I just suppose it was convenient. And she said, no, it's because of the glare.
Oh.
I said, oh, as well.
Yes.
And as a son of an optometrist, I thought immediately, totally, you know.
Is that like being a son of a dentist?
Negligent.
A child with
yes,
the most
absolutely.
Holes in their teeth. Yeah.
Furthermore, Tom had been complaining. He was doing a master's degree in fine arts at the time, and he was working on his computer late into the night, and he was also commenting on his difficulty in getting to sleep. So I joined the dots, and it occurred to me that there were two things that needed addressing here.
Mm.
And the first thing was protecting his eyes against the glare so he wouldn't be surfing when the sharks are around. Mm-hmm. And secondly, addressing the blue light coming from his computer screen. That was inhibiting the melatonin from his pineal gland that... Otherwise would help him sleep. So I did that. He got two pairs of glasses and they both worked really well. So he was able to get a much better night's sleep. Now, this is almost 10 years ago, and this really triggered in my mind some important thoughts. And I straight away started to ask my patients who were working on their computers at night, you know, how well do you sleep? It's not a common question that an optometrist necessarily might ask their patients, but I certainly thought it was an interesting question to ask, and I might discover and learn something. And I was surprised how many patients said to me, look, I have, you know, a terrible time trying to get to sleep. And yes, I do work on my computer. I'm obliged to. I remember a few patients saying, you know, I work in the evening because I have to. I have to manage a database. I have to re-index databases.
It's the only time you can do the work sometimes.
Exactly, when the computer at work is quiet and you can fix it all up. So... I had great success, let's just say, with prescribing for these patients. It took a little bit of learning on my part to discover what wavelengths of light are responsible for keeping us awake and how to prescribe the correct colour of spectacular lenses.
And that's my question is... So this was actually – we've been reading about this sort of thing in the papers and on, you know, on websites, et cetera, for a few years now. We're getting messages from iPhone, you know, to put nightshade, is it? Is that the setting? There's a fitting that Apple have that
that's
you can
right.
actually
–
night
right.
shift, it's called.
That's correct, yes.
But this – you were doing all this before all of this sort of information was coming out.
Yes, I certainly was learning about it. I was drilling into it, and it didn't take long for me to then start to join a few more dots. And my research took me in the direction of how there are, in fact, beneficial effects, for example, of sunlight. It boils...
Which are?
Well, 480 nanometers is a good start. I mean, it is a
what
version...
What does that mean?
We learn it when we're at school. Roy G. Biv, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Mm-hmm. It's indigo, right? And at that wavelength of light... I'm just digressing here slightly, but never
I'm
mind.
Taking you in that direction, yeah.
at 480 nanometers, which is, as I said, a version of blue light in sunlight, naturally in sunlight, let's call it the good blue light of indigo, that triggers a response on the retina, we now understand very well, extremely well. Brilliant biologists. They're a whole genre unto themselves. These are the vision researchers.
Okay.
And these guys have spent decades looking into how the photochemistry of vision actually works. And, of course, I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on this, but there's another genre that deals with the sleep sciences.
Yes.
And these people have spent decades researching all this. What I'm trying to convey, I suppose, is that there is a vast reservoir of knowledge out there now. And I started scratching around on the surface, and it was immediately apparent that this magic wavelength of 480 nanometers triggered a biological response on the retina. And there's a very, very specific cell there call the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cell, mm-hmm. and we'll call them IPRGCs.
I was going to say, there's got to be an acronym there.
An IPRGC. And yeah. we've hypothesized on their existence for about 20 years, but we've really only known about them intimately for probably 10 or so. And these guys are these little cells on our retina. There's not many of them, by the way. They're few and far between, right? They occupy only...
But incredibly powerful by the sounds of it.
Incredibly powerful. Mm. And these guys regulate our sleep for a start. Mm-hmm. So that same wavelength is the most potent, 480 nanometers, at inhibiting sleepiness. Right?
The melatonin secretion?
Or it inhibits, yes, exactly. It inhibits melatonin. Mm-hmm. Two words we need to not confuse, and that's melatonin. And the actual chemical inside the IPRGC is melanopsin.
Oh, okay. Yes.
So IPRGC's melanopsin has its absorbs light maximally at 480 nanometers. So that's how it triggers these IPRGCs to send a signal to your brain that ultimately goes through a couple of pathways, and that ultimately inhibits melatonin and keeps us awake. Of course, when the light goes down and it's dark, the cells turn off and melatonin is then released and we feel sleepy. Now, we discovered that these cells, the IPRGCs, also synapse, that is, connect with other cells in the retina called amacrine cells, and they are a tiny little reservoir of dopamine. Now, dopamine is a neurotransmitter. And when IPRGCs are stimulated, they also cause amacrine cells to release dopamine. Mm-hmm. The dopamine, in turn, binds with receptors on the white of our eye and stabilizes eye growth. Myopia is a condition when the eyes don't know when to stop growing.
Okay.
And they continue to grow and grow and grow. And as they do so, they no longer accurately focus light on the back. And you have to put some lenses in front to fix it up. That's myopia.
Yes.
Just backtracking slightly, eyes do grow normally.
Continue. Like
from birth to the age of nine.
To nine.
Nine. And at the age of 9 years, they stop growing. We have a name for that process, and it's called the emmetropization process. And we understand it. Again, the vision scientists have been very busy for a very long time. And we understand the emmetropization process quite well. And providing our eyes are exposed to around about 2 to 3 hours of sunlight per day, naturally, then the eyes know when to stop growing.
Right.
If you like the sunlight, I like to use the word, it helps the eyes calibrate themselves, right? So they recover, what we've discovered. They recover, for example, normally after long periods of reading if they're getting their correct dose of sunlight.
So what if they get too much sunlight?
As far as the red...
Or this blue spectrum of light, is that what you're saying?
If... we don't know. I don't know the answer to that question, to be quite honest with you. I don't think anyone's sort of shone, which is a reasonable question. I don't think anyone has studied the mammalian eye's response to overdosing on 480 nanometers. But what I can tell you is this. There are other wavelengths of blue that are toxic to the retina, the back of the eye, and they are the short wavelength blue. There's a wonderful paper. It was written by the lead author was Emily Arnault, and her colleagues published this in 2013. And it was a groundbreaking paper. And what Arnault and others found was that short wavelength blue was highly toxic for the retina. And too much of it caused damage to some of the photosensitive, light-sensitive elements of the eyes, and particularly over time caused damage to the foundation layer of the retina, the retinal pigmentary epithelium. So Arnault's work was very, very important in being one of the first papers to show us that it wasn't necessarily the intensity of the light that was the key issue.
So what is?
Wavelength.
Right.
It's the wavelength. And it's that short wavelength blue. It's actually 435 nanometers plus or minus 20 nanometers. So it's 415 to 455 is the most toxic wavelength of light.
And so let's go back to the point that you were saying that you, I'm going to go right back to the beginning here, that your son had this issue and you decided to research and try and help him and that you gave him two sets of glasses.
I did. The light from his computer screen, there must have been some blue in there, obviously, at 480 nanometers, highly likely, you know, indigo. It's a pretty common colour, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I then found out which version of yellow, which is the complementary colour to blue, which version of yellow, you know, is going to block 480 nanometers. I put it into a pair of specs and fixed him up.
Great.
Simple.
Simple.
Not rocket science.
No.
No. Elementary, really.
And because I've heard of some hospitals, actually. You know, you imagine these hospitals that are brilliantly lit, and we'll start talking about interior lighting and things in a minute, but these hospitals that are brilliantly lit, and they need to be at night so that they can see the blood and you know, what's going on in the human body. Which is great for the nurses and the doctors that need to see what's happening, but really bad for the patient who's not getting their circadian rhythm in the correct cycle, et cetera. So they're actually talking now about fitting patients with yellow glasses, which actually eradicate this.
Certainly, I guess the first thing that springs to my mind is that nothing terribly wrong with a suggestion, but to me that's a bit of a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
I would suggest that it's more sensible to address the light in the first instance. And, of course, this is happening. It's happening now. It's reasonably mainstream for aged care facilities, for example, to be fitted with what we call human-centric lighting, which is lighting that changes its intensity, and engineers like to refer to the colour temperature, which is, you know, it's white and bright and cool. They call that a cool when it's very, very white. Or when it's more yellow, they call that warm. So engineers would refer to it as, you know, changing the brightness, the luminance, the radiance, and the colour temperature over time. This is a good start, but it's not the complete answer. And the reason it's not the complete answer is that the lights that do this are LED lights, and the way LED lights are manufactured these days is they have a peak blue at about 430 nanometers.
Oh, there's a correlation there.
There is. That's right. It has something to do with the health of the retina that Arnold discovered, you see. I hasten to add that others followed Arnold. She wasn't alone. And there was a flurry of activity. And there were some important papers published after her. And I'd direct our listeners to Francine Bahar-Cohen, and I'd... there are others, Shang, and so on. And what they did was in the laboratory, they exposed mammals, which is typically rodents, which have a remarkably, may I say, similar retina to us humans. There are some subtle differences. They don't see quite the same colours we do. But nevertheless, the impact on the biology of their retina is the same as ours. And the vision scientists, biologists, discovered that, you know, light at a radiance that we experience on a daily basis in our offices and schools.
So in our artificially lit.
In our artificially lit environment, if you put that in a laboratory mammal, you will see retinal damage. It usually takes 36 hours or more.
Consistent?
No, 12-hour shifts.
Okay.
So 12 hours on, 12 hours off.
So right? You're saying so that within 3 days...
Correct. Yep. That's right. That's right. Now, you can start to draw your own conclusions about the effect on the young, transparent eye, for example, of our school children and those at university and college, etc., and even those in offices. What is the impact on LED lighting with a blue peak at 430 nanometers, look it up, not hard to do. And you'll see it's called the spectral power distribution.
Okay.
And you'll see that the spectral power distribution of current LED globes has a blue peak at 400, usually 430, 440 nanometers. And if you recall my comment earlier, it's 415 to 455 is the toxic range.
That's right.
As it happens, they have a trough at 480 nanometers, so little or none. At that wavelength, that is most beneficial for preventing myopia.
Right.
Right.
This is your patent.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So what we've done is we've tried our best, and of course it's an evolutionary process. I'm sure there'll be more to follow. But what we've done is address that. It's a relatively simple step to manufacture LED lights so that their blue peak, if you will, is shifted. That's okay. All one is doing. So mm-hmm. one is shifting it away from the hazardous range mm-hmm. to the healthy range.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some will say, but hang on a moment. You've just shifted the blue peak to 480, Stephen.
Mm.
And that's the you know wavelength that keeps us awake.
Yes.
Yes.
You need to do it at the right time of the day.
Yeah, you are. Mm. So mm. the wonderful thing is this, and those who've done a little bit of reading on it will know, in human-centric lighting, it's quite normal process to have our LED lights connected to a processor, a computer, mm. an algorithm that actually adjusts that
mm-hmm.
wavelength, radiance mm-hmm. over time.
Fantastic.
So, of course, mm-hmm. later in the day, mm-hmm. the 480 is gone, G-O-N-E. Yes. It has mm-hmm. to be. Why mm-hmm. wouldn't it be? Because mm-hmm. we all want
you
a
need
good,
to go into that cycle.
We yep. all want mm-hmm. a good night's sleep.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Fantastic.
There you are.
So why isn't everyone picking up this technology, jumping at it? Sounds amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Well, certainly I'll answer this as diplomatically as I possibly can. And it goes along these lines. I have been in lengthy conversations with more than one major in the world of global LED lighting manufacture. A couple of important things to reflect on here. LED globes, as they are made today, as I said, with this unhelpful spectral power mm-hmm. distribution, look, no one set out to make a bad light.
No, they just right? did what they did.
They yeah. did what they did mm, because mm. that was how things had been evolved, if mm-hmm. you will, in mm-hmm. the past. But as it happens, it turns out that there, if you will, you can think of an LED module, we call it, as a combination of two important components.
Mm-hmm.
One is a pure blue. It's called the blue pump, and that's a blue LED light. Right?
Yeah, light-emitting diode.
Mm-hmm. Light-emitting diode.
Mm-hmm.
It's electricity going through semiconductors.
Yeah.
And on top of that is a phosphor coat. As the blue light goes through the phosphor, there is an excitation of the atoms in the phosphor,
mm-hmm.
and the combination of the blue and the yellow produces what we see as white light.
Mm-hmm.
Blue plus yellow equals white.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as it happens, LED lights, as they are made today, it's a very, very efficient combination of the blue light pump and the phosphor coat.
Mm-hmm.
And it means that LED globes, LED modules, you know, they dramatically reduce the consumption of energy, for example, over a fluorescent light, possibly 60, 65, even perhaps 70% less energy.
Which is why everyone's jumping
that's
on it.
That's right.
Yeah. And it took off because of that. It was a carbon footprint
That's
reducer.
Exactly right. Yeah. We want to save our polar bears, and so we should, and absolutely so we should.
Mm.
However, when you start modifying the spectral power distribution from an LED globe, number one, it's not going to be quite as efficient. I'm talking 2 or 3% here.
Right.
Right?
Mm.
So if you make an LED module to my specifications, and just to be clear here, we're talking without confusing too many people, we would be talking about a globe, right? So that's quite a big step, an expensive step too for a manufacturer to undertake.
Mm.
So to produce a globe that does what I would suggest is a good idea, it's an expensive step, and number one, you have to, you know, gear up your factories.
Mm.
And number two, the globe itself is 2 or 3% not as efficient as they are now, right? So if you're in the business of selling, you know, globes to industry or LED lights to industry and the market in general, and you want to say we have the most efficient form of lighting, then there are trade-offs, I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
There would be a few percentage points in trade-offs. Now, the next question we have to ask ourselves is this. If we do nothing, by 2050, half of the world's population will be myopic. 96% of graduates from university in South Korea and China, 96% are myopic. 80% of high school graduates in China are myopic.
Mm-hmm.
52% of 19 to 29-year-olds in France are myopic.
Mm.
We need to ask ourselves the question, well, where do we best spend our money? Of those people who are myopic, which is more, will be around half the world's population by 2050, it's a growing problem. I think I've made that clear.
Absolutely.
Of those, 10% will have a high visual error. And those 10% suffer the threat of blindness in their old age.
Yes.
From a myopic version of macular degeneration, a myopic version of glaucoma, cataract and retinal detachment.
Mm.
All of those pathologies, they are far more frequent in the highly myopic eye.
Yes.
If you do the arithmetic, you've got about 1.4 billion people in China at the moment. And if 90 or 96% of university graduates, but let's go back to 80% of high school graduates.
Mm.
So what we're talking about here is urban Chinese people. We are talking a large number of people in the population now who in their old age are going to have serious
eye issues.
I see the tsunami coming, you see.
Mm.
And there's not a day to waste, you see. So to answer your question, why hasn't it taken off? Well, it will, I'm pleased to say. Progress is being made.
Fantastic.
In that direction,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
However, there's not a day to lose. And we really do need to turn our mind to, you know, helping our younger, particularly our younger folk.
Well, this is what we do, isn't it? We inflict a problem onto the generation below us. Just as a related aside, I was reading a piece the other day on, I don't know if you've heard, but France has recently just set a nationwide standard that all their streetlights won't be any brighter than 2,700 Kelvin or around national parks or wildlife areas 2,200.
Mm.
And it started a conversation around how Asians in particular really love this bright white blue lights for their buildings and things. That there's a cultural propensity to use that colour. They really like it. So I'm wondering, I mean, it's just an interest, you know, with your statistics that you've just given there as well, which came first. The cultural sway towards that sort of colour?
Yeah, it's interesting to say that. I was in China towards the end of last year, and we were hosted by some lovely, friendly people there and who took us out to dinner. And I couldn't help but notice that in the restaurant, the lighting was just as you described. I didn't quite understand why. I happened to raise it with one of the hosts, and I said, gee whiz, you know, the light's pretty white and bright in here. He said, yes, that's how we like it.
Yes. Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Look, I wish to make this point. Engineers are very fond of talking about the correlated colour temperature, which you just quoted.
Yes.
2,700 Kelvin and so on. And we know that as that number gets higher, the lighting gets whiter. So part of my role is to try and convey to engineers that we can talk about correlated colour temperature, but it's a lot more helpful if we talk about the wavelengths rather than CCT. We should be putting correlated colour temperature to one side. It's convenient because you can quote a number.
Yes.
Right? However, we can still, listen carefully, we can still enjoy excellent outdoor illumination with our current technology and we can remove that short wavelength blue light, which contributes to light pollution, which contributes to harmful scattered light. It's scattered the most, the short wavelength blur, Rayleigh scattering and so on, Tyndall scattering through the eye. We can minimise light pollution and we can improve visual performance with lighting that has a better improved spectral power distribution, which has the short wavelength blue minimised, but at the same time is warmer.
Yes, yeah.
If you think about it, actually, by removing the short wavelength blue straight away, you tend to make a light more yellow, right? So we're going in the correct direction here. But that's part of my role over the last few years. What I've had the privilege of talking to audiences in North America and in Europe, largely engineers and those distributors and manufacturers of LED lighting. And what a friendly and warm reception I've received. The rest of the world is really catching on to this, and there
Australia's
you are.
Australia's slow at this,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, and yeah. France, you mentioned. As it happens, some of the most fabulous research, Emily Arnault, for example, and her team are all based in France at the University of Pierre and Madame Curie. So amazing research. Some of the best research in the impact of short wavelength blue on the retina, that's precisely where this research comes from.
I was going to pick up on Australian engineers, and you said that your product, your patent might come to the fore. What where do you see that coming? How is that going to enlighten us?
Oh, fantastic question. Again, I have to be a little bit diplomatic here and be mindful of where we're up to with this, but it's our hope, put it that way, that light such as ours would become commonplace, for example, in our schools and universities and our offices. Certainly schools, I think, is a wonderful place to start. You have the younger transparent eyes here. We know that more blue gets through that eye than through the older eye. When I say older, I really mean over the age of 40, to be honest.
It's not that old.
Which is not that old. But over the age of 40 or so, the crystalline lens in our eye starts to become a little bit more yellow. Therefore, it's absorbing some of the blue. You with me? There is a paradox here, I hasten to add, and the alert listener will say, well, hang on, I've read Arnault's paper, and what Arnault says is short wavelength blue is really, really bad for some very old eyes that contain a protein called A2E. A2E is a metabolic byproduct that tends to accumulate in the older retina. And ultimately, we see it at the back of the eye. It's a precursor to macular degeneration. And we call it drusen, D-R-U-S-E-N, right? So when we look in an older eye, we see these little yellow spots on the retina. We call them drusen. We now know they contain this protein, A2E. And guess what? A2E really absorbs high-energy blue light. High-energy, short-wavelength blue, and that's what Arnault's paper particularly dealt with. And she showed that these retinae loaded with A2E deteriorated very, very rapidly with short-wavelength blue light, to my point that it's the younger and paradoxically also the very old, you know? Is there a window in between where it doesn't matter? No. I say to you all,
eye health always matters.
Eye health always matters.
So that actually brings me to the to a question that I have often posed to me when I do public talks about why is it, and it's always the older people in the audience, why are those white lights on headlights, why are they affecting their eyes so much? And you've basically just answered it because,
There is another important reason. And there is one particular engineer in North America who deserves more recognition, Nisa Khan. And she's done some incredibly important work in this space. And what she has pointed out to us is how directional LED lights really are. In other words, the light from an LED surface, and I use that word advisedly, it's a flat surface. And because, if you think about it, in nature, no light sources are typically flat. If you think of the sun and you think of stars, you think even of a tungsten globe with its filaments and so on, that we all thought, you know, and reasonably thought as a nice light to have, right? Not energy efficient, but nice to have and work by and so on. These sources don't have a flat surface that emit light. LEDs do. And if Nisa Khan has done the mathematics on this, may I say exquisite mathematics on this, and I hope she gets the recognition she deserves. This source of light, LED surface, emits a highly directional version of light. And in our car headlights and elsewhere where we're confronted by these lights straight into our eyes, terribly glary. Now, I wish to use, again, that term glare is an important one because there's a couple of components here. The glare is from the directional nature of LED lighting.
Okay.
Flare, I like to call it, on the other hand, is, if you will, the glow around it. And it's the flare that's maximised by short wavelength blue. And it's the glare that is produced by the flat surface.
Okay. Fantastic explanation. There you are. Great. Thank you. Well, I think that answers most of my questions and probably most of our audience. There's been some fantastic information. But just to finish up, I know that you have an association with astronomy, a childhood association, and this is called Dark Sky Conversations. So I'd love to know the time that you treasure most about being under a night sky.
Oh, I can answer that very easily. I do. I can answer that extremely easily. Yes, well, I think you're alluding to the fact that, and we spoke about this once before, my father he was an amateur astronomer, and he hand-ground the reflecting mirror for his telescope. It was a tube about 14 inches in diameter, and it stood about 6 foot tall, I suppose. And in the bottom of it was this mirror that he ground by hand. I remember the process very well.
It probably took ages.
Oh, it took months and months. and I was only probably, I don't know, 10 or 11 years of age or something. I do recall vividly, it was July, it was winter, and I was freezing cold, and we're in the backyard using the telescope, and Neil Armstrong had just landed on the moon. And we had our neighbours and friends around, you know. Mum was busy serving hot cups of tea to everybody to try and stay warm. And a couple of things do stick in my mind. The first thing is, after looking through the telescope at the moon for a while, when I came away, I couldn't see much out of – it was a monocular, by the way. I couldn't see much out of my eye that I'd had to the telescope eyepiece, you know. I can even remember it was a Barlow lens. So there you are. It was top of the range. And the other thing I do remember was everyone thought it quite a joke we couldn't see Neil Armstrong, you know. The telescope wasn't quite powerful enough. That's my vivid memory of the night sky. And this is in a little country town up on the north coast. So in 1966, 67, wasn't it? I think it was 1967.
Well, we're coming to the 50th anniversary this year.
69, was it? There you are. Well, there you are. I do remember it was winter, and I have a vivid memory of that, and it stays with me.
Yes. Yeah, fantastic. Well, on that very memorable note, we'll sign off. But thank you very much.
Thanks, Marnie.
Talking to you.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, great. So on that note, if you've got any questions for us, you can send them along to us at podcast@darkskytraveller.com.au. Or you could tweet us or Instagram us at DarkSkyOz. If you'd like to take a look at one of Stephen's presentations, you could go to lightsafe.com.au. But when you are online and listening, please take the moment to review us and subscribe. Thank you. That's it for this week. Lights out.